Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, July 27th, 2025. From the latest issue of EOS, published by the AGU, the American Geophysical Union, the May 2025 issue, Delegations Drive One Water Dialogues, by Grace Van Dielen. Proactive approaches allow water practitioners to address issues in innovative, inclusive ways. On a summer morning, a storm dropped buckets of rain on the desert outside Tucson, Arizona. Water ran over the dry soil. Most of the water subsequently evaporated, but some parched plants drank their fill. What was left over sank into the ground, percolating into the aquifer below. A few kilometers down the road, Tucson Water pumped groundwater from the same aquifer to a nearby reservoir, then through its treatment system. A Tucson ratepayer turned on her tap and used a few liters of water to give her dog a bath. The soiled water flowed into Tucson's wastewater system and once again was treated. A portion of that recycled wastewater was released into the Santa Cruz River, where parkgoers enjoyed watching it flow through the city. In Tucson, as in the rest of the world, every human interaction with water is connected to a broader water system. But water practitioners haven't always treated their work with the same interconnected approach. Instead, many cities and regions divide their water into three silos: drinking water, wastewater, and stormwater, each managed separately. That approach is not meeting the needs of many communities, and a different approach called One Water is beginning to take its place. One Water treats drinking water, wastewater, and stormwater as a single, interconnected entity and attempts to manage it holistically, bringing together water utilities, community members, business and industry leaders, researchers, politicians, engineers, and advocacy groups. In a One Water approach, the Tucson ratepayer, water utility, and parkgoer are equal stakeholders, and water practitioners attempt to create a water system that works well for each of them. Partnerships and collaboration are at its core, said Scott Berry, Director of Policy and Government Affairs at the U.S. Water Alliance, a nonprofit membership organization dedicated to advancing a One Water future for all. A holistic, inclusive approach is not without obstacles, though. Different stakeholders bring different priorities and practices and may have cultural, historical, regulatory, and organizational barriers that keep them from collaborating effectively. To navigate such challenges, water stakeholders from varied sectors across the United States come together at an annual conference, soon to be held every 18 months, the One Water Summit, hosted by the U.S. Water Alliance. About 70% of attendees come as part of a delegation, a peer group, typically organized by region, whose members want to work together on U.S. water issues. These delegations are the lifeblood of the summit and uniquely mirror the One Water approach. They're meant to be highly collaborative, allowing stakeholders with very different priorities to come together and work toward a common cause. Though the framework is hindered by funding constraints and a lack of engagement from some sectors, delegations have provided a valuable opportunity for sharing knowledge and bringing One Water projects to fruition. Siloed systems. In the water sector, siloed systems are the norm. The inertia they engender can be hard to break when trying to build collaborative networks. In some cases, siloed approaches contribute to unaligned regulations, which can limit a collaboration's success, explained Katie Peterson, a research fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California's Water Policy Center. For example, someone working on a wastewater problem must navigate both environmental and health regulations. A One Water program might involve potable reuse or recycling wastewater into drinking water by purifying it, filtering it, and diverting it to groundwater or reservoir supplies. Such a project needs to ensure that the recycled water complies with environmental regulations that govern water quality for irrigation and other non-potable uses. But once that water is destined for a drinking water supply, it must also comply with health regulations. A little bit of streamlining of those regulations can bolster collaboration, Peterson said. Siloed jurisdictions can present another challenge for water practitioners. Though the flow of water respects no political or system boundary, water managers do work within such jurisdictions, said Saren Pokhrel, a water resource engineer for the Environment and Protected Areas Ministry of Alberta, Canada. Some local governments within Alberta, such as Edmonton, where Pokhrel is based, use a one-water approach. British Columbia, where Pokhrel previously worked, is home to an array of jurisdictions. Municipalities govern water via local bylaws, Indigenous communities manage their own water, and districts follow broader regional plans. Unifying plans under a single framework that all levels of water management can follow is very challenging, he said. The U.S. Water Alliance added the delegation structure to its annual conference in 2016 as a way for water practitioners to overcome these barriers and move toward one water ideals. Barry, who leads delegation work at the U.S. Water Alliance, said he thinks of the delegation system as an opportunity for stakeholders to road test collaborations. It's this idea of getting a bunch of folks together who may not work together often or who may even be at odds with one another, he said. It's a way to test the waters of collaboration away from the normal sphere of influence. Organizers of the One Water Summit encourage delegations, which can be assembled by anyone with the interest, ability, and time, to recruit fellow delegates to attend. Delegation members can register at a discounted rate, and the summit provides opt-in programming specifically for delegates. Around 1,000 people and 20 to 40 delegations attend each year. Membership in any one delegation has ranged from fewer than 10 to almost 50 people, Barry said. The first half day of each summit is dedicated to peer exchanges, where delegations present their work to each other. These presentations range from showcasing a particular success to workshopping a problem that the delegation is facing, Barry said. At the 2023 Tucson Summit, for example, the Tap Into Resilience delegation hosted a peer exchange to brainstorm how to scale up distributed water infrastructure, a type of ultra-local water system meant to be more affordable than conventional water systems. The Climate Action delegation shared strategies for utilities to use capital investments to make progress on their climate plans. And the New Jersey delegates hosted a discussion about how delegations can build relationships with state governments to advance One Water. At an end of summit plenary, delegations are invited to announce commitments to action for the coming year. The entire plenary, you're surrounded by all this amazing work that's going to be happening in all these different places, Barry said. You get a sense that you're not alone, and that there are opportunities for collaboration. Commitments to action range from informal directives to full proposals. Delegations at the 2023 summit committed to developing new One Water plans for their cities, improving community engagement around water issues, sharing what they learned with local leaders and policymakers, and constructing new green stormwater and water treatment facilities. Delegations that return to the subsequent summit are encouraged to share how they've progressed on their commitments. One Water, Many Networks. Water practitioners report a strengthening of the depth and breadth of their collaborations as a result of participating in a delegation. I felt like I really got to know people in a different way, and not just as colleagues, but as friends, said Rebecca Jones, Communications Director for the Iowa Soybean Association's Iowa Agriculture Water Alliance, who attended the 2023 One Water Summit as part of the delegation from Iowa. Jones deepened her relationships with colleagues at the City of Cedar Rapids and Des Moines Waterworks, and especially enjoyed meeting members of a delegation from Hawaii, who shared how critical water is to Hawaiian culture and livelihoods. Jennifer Walker of the Texas delegation, director of the Texas Coast and Water Program at the National Wildlife Federation, said she feels the same after attending multiple summits. When a delegation convenes away from their home community, everybody has a little bit more time to focus on the content, spend some time together, and build relationships, she said. Because Texas is such a large state, the delegation venue is crucial for getting Texas stakeholders, including nonprofits, utilities, engineers, consultants, elected officials, and community members in the same room. The delegation are building relationships among people who don't work together day to day, said Michelle Stockness, executive director of the Freshwater Society, a nonprofit based in St. Paul, Minnesota. Stockness attended the 2023 summit as a member of the Minnesota delegation. We are building these relationships so that we can talk about hard things a little more easily. We can come together in ways that would be almost impossible at home, said Candace Ruprecht, a water conservation program manager for the city of Tucson and member of the Tucson delegation, in a 2019 presentation. Strengthened relationships have sparked meaningful progress on one water projects across the country. At the 2023 conference, the Iowa delegation held an educational session about urban and rural collaboration via an exercise about a fictional town called Farmersville and its picturesque Crystal River. Attendees attempted to fix a water quality problem in Farmersville, a suddenly odorous and murky Crystal River, while playing a role that was different from their real-life job. For example, a water researcher could act as mayor, and a utility staff member could role-play a farmer. In the scenario, the urban community blamed rural farmers for soil erosion and nutrient pollution, whereas farmers accused the city of industrial pollution and ineffective waste management. Workshop attendees had to navigate these concerns as they developed a plan to improve water quality. It got people thinking out of the box about what it's like to be in someone else's shoes, Jones said. In New Jersey, water practitioners had already formed a coalition of community members, nonprofit organizations, government entities, and utilities when the delegation from the state began attending the summit in 2016. Participating as a delegation supplemented the group's holistic effort, said Paula Figueroa, director of the Jersey Water Works Collaborative and a former New Jersey delegate. For the New Jersey delegation, the summit is an important source of energy to balance the sometimes draining, difficult work of advancing a one water approach, she said. After the 2022 summit, Figueroa noticed that two leaders, one a New Jersey utility staff member and the other an employee of the Jersey Waterworks Collaborative, began to collaborate, inviting each other to more events and sharing the other's work. The new relationship increased the visibility of a shared primary project, replacing lead service lines across the state. The summit offers delegations opportunities for interstate cooperation as well. Following conversations between the Pittsburgh and Milwaukee delegations at the 2022 and 2023 summits, delegates from Pennsylvania and Wisconsin held a dedicated learning exchange in Milwaukee the following year. Some water issues in Pittsburgh would have taken 2 or 3 years each to solve, but as a result of knowledge gained in the Wisconsin exchange, we were able to complete 5 or 6 problems in 2 or 3 years, said Jamil Bey, founder of the Urbankind Institute and a longtime member of the Pittsburgh delegation. That learning exchange model is really helpful. The event in Milwaukee helped inform a new approach to assessing and addressing stormwater reclamation in Pittsburgh, for instance, said Kelly Henderson, who was part of the Pittsburgh cohort that attended the learning exchange. One of the locations the group visited was Green Tech Station, a former brownfield site that the Northwest Side Community Development Corporation, a nonprofit in Milwaukee, had transformed into a stormwater reclamation facility. Green Tech Station can capture more than 380,000 liters of stormwater each time it rains, water that is then used to irrigate trees on the site. The facility also includes a prairie ecosystem with native plants, a pavilion to host educational programming, and a collection of artwork. Henderson, Executive Director of Grounded Strategies, a nonprofit focused on community-driven vacant lot reclamation, found Green Tech Station so inspiring that she decided to create something similar in Pittsburgh. Grounded Strategies, along with partners from the Department of City Planning in Pittsburgh and the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority and elsewhere, recently received a $55,000 grant to start the project. As they plan the site, they'll be in close contact with the group that constructed Green Tech Station, Henderson said. Delegations can also facilitate cooperation between stakeholders with different immediate interests. In 2017, for example, the Tucson delegation committed to a lofty goal, returning perennial water flow to the Santa Cruz River. At the time, the stretch of the river in downtown Tucson flowed only during rainstorms. Ruprecht, the Tucson Water Conservation Manager and four-time Tucson delegation member, said delegation members were key to advocating for Arizona's drought contingency plan, a change in state law that increased recycled water recharge credits. Under the drought contingency plan, Tucson Water can receive credits for 95% of the water released into the Santa Cruz River, then use those credits in the future to secure additional water supply. Within a year, Tucson Water's Santa Cruz River Heritage Project had released enough recycled water to the river that it flowed anew for the first time in almost 80 years. The new stretch of perennial river restored plants, revitalized a cienega, a wetland, ecosystem, and provided new habitat for wildlife such as herons, native toads, coyotes, and dragonflies. Inclusivity obstacles. Though many delegations have made tangible progress toward One Water goals, barriers still exist to achieving full cross-sector engagement. With something like One Water, if you don't do a good job of building those relationships and building those ties between sectors, then there's a risk it could be just some pleasant marketing, but not really delivering the outcomes that it's supposed to deliver, Peterson said. One major barrier is money. Attending the summit comes at a financial cost that can be too high for underfunded organizations. It's all about money, said Pockrell, the Alberta engineer. Do we have enough budget? Do we have enough resources to fulfill this? Most of the most vulnerable people who are having water issues, they don't have the resources to participate, Bay said. There's a minimum threshold for organizational capacity that you have to connect you to these types of conversations. The U.S. Water Alliance tries to help delegates from underfunded organizations attend the summit with a tiered registration fee system. If you're a small nonprofit, you're going to pay less than a private company or a large urban utility, Barry said. The people who are more resourced, who can afford to pay more, do pay more. And that helps us subsidize the cost for the folks who are less well-resourced. A little funding can go a long way to help include historically marginalized voices. With help from a grant from the U.S. Water Alliance, for instance, in 2023, the Minnesota delegation was able to invite representatives from the indigenous-led nonprofit Honor the Earth, as well as community members from the Environmental Justice Coordinating Council, or EJCC. Members of EJCC had previously attended the 2022 One Water Summit in Milwaukee, where they had committed to working on issues of environmental health in Minnesota, particularly the impact of per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, on drinking water. Providing funding for community and tribal members was really important to get the people we wanted to be there and have that diverse representation of multiple perspectives, Stockness said. Delegates from Honor the Earth and EJCC could not be reached for comment in time for publication. Barry and some past delegates said they feel that the agriculture industry is underrepresented at the summits, too. Agriculture is a huge element of the water system, responsible for about 70% of freshwater use worldwide. The proportion of agriculture practitioners at the summit is still not as big as it could be or should be, said Sean McMahon, a sustainable agriculture consultant who has been involved in coordinating the Iowa delegation for five summits. City utilities make up the majority of membership in the U.S. Water Alliance, and urban organizations dominate the summit, a dynamic that may make the rural agriculture community feel ostracized, Peterson said. If members of the agriculture community are not engaging in a collaboration, that might mean the benefit of participating is not clear to them. As in the fictional Farmersville, agriculture communities and urban water suppliers may not always see eye to eye. Farmers may be frustrated with what they see as overly restrictive regulations in an already difficult economic environment, whereas urban utilities prioritize delivering clean drinking water to their ratepayers. The agriculture sector often gets cast as a villain and may feel that it must defend itself against other water practitioners who aren't familiar with the hardships of farm operations, Peterson said. Making clear to farmers the mutual benefits of a one water approach could improve collaboration. For instance, many sustainable agricultural practices both benefit farm finances and improve downstream water quality. McMahon recommended that delegation leaders reach out to agriculture associations to find champions of improving water quality and water use efficiency. If you're framing your proposal like, "Come help us talk about these complicated issues from your perspective," it's like a wide open door to have really powerful conversations, said Jones. Claire Lindahl, Chief Executive Officer of the Soil and Water Conservation Society, a member of the Soil and Water Conservation Delegation, and a board member of the U.S. Water Alliance, said her delegation has had success building relationships across the urban and rural divide by emphasizing the value of water to all stakeholders. "The water is the bridge," she said. When a highly diverse group of stakeholders makes it to the summit, collaborations can lead to what Figueroa called a healthy push and pull. Everyone sitting around the table may have different expectations, goals, and work practices. Delegations have found that defining common goals and outlining clear responsibilities are the best way around that. For example, the New Jersey group has centered its conversations around four shared goals: having effective and financially sustainable water systems, empowering stakeholders, and ensuring that they are well informed, building successful beneficial green infrastructure, and creating smart combined sewer overflow control systems. "That's our North Star, and that has helped us," Figueroa said. "It's hard to break down silos if your objectives aren't clear," Peterson said. "Being really candid and clear about who's involved, what the roles are, and what the responsibilities are for the beginning, middle, and end of the project can help," she said. Barry said he has high hopes for the future of delegations. He imagines an eventual Colorado River delegation that would include stakeholders from throughout the Colorado River Basin. Other dreams include a Great Lakes delegation and a Mississippi River delegation. "There's so much ground to cover," he said. "It's both a resources and money question, and it's a relationship question," Barry said. And this article, "Delegations Drive One Water Dialogues: Proactive Approaches Allow Water Practitioners to Address Issues in Innovative, Inclusive Ways," appears in the May 2025 issue of EOS, published by the AGU, or American Geophysical Union. Next, the March 2025 issue of Science News, an article that is part of a series on what happens after the California fires. This one is written by Nick Ogasa, a staff writer for Science News, and he is no stranger to covering wildfires. It all started in 2020 when he was a graduate student at the University of California, Santa Cruz. The CZU Lightning Complex fires had spread across the mountains near campus, and Ogasa wrote about the calamity. It was then that he learned about the dangers of massive waves of debris-laced mud that can occur after wildfires. That's a problem because debris flows can strike suddenly, he says. So when devastating infernos erupted in the Los Angeles area in January of this year, he got to reporting on researchers' efforts to assess the debris flow risk. The process was emotionally challenging for Ogasso, who is from Southern California and has family there. But, he says, writing about the fires helped me by making me feel that I was contributing somehow, and that made me feel a little less helpless. The next risk, landslides. In the section called From the Ashes. The L.A. wildfires were still burning when scientists began scouting the freshly charred burn scars to search for signs of another potential danger, roaring torrents of rock and mud and water that can sweep downhill with deadly momentum. Triggered by intense rainfall, these debris flows become more likely after an intense wildfire has scorched an area's slopes. At least half of their volume is sediment, and it's mixed with burned trees, cars, and boulders. It's like concrete moving downhill, says geologist Jamie Kostelnik of the U.S. Geological Survey in Golden, Colorado. Debris flows can carry a lot of material and can swell to five times as high as a flash flood, she says. Basically, a flood on steroids. Debris flows can hit speeds of about 56 kilometers per hour as they careen through valleys, canyons, and stream channels. Some gain so much momentum that they carve new paths. Due to their quick and powerful nature, debris flows can be devastating. In January 2018, debris flows in Montecito, California, killed 23 people and damaged or destroyed over 400 homes just a month after the Thomas Fire started. The mountainous areas of Los Angeles County are known for debris flows after blazes like the 2009 Station Fire and 2016 San Gabriel Complex Fire, both of which were near the recent Eaton Fire. The steep terrain and the fact that California is in its wet season leads us to believe that the level of hazard is going to be quite high, Kostelnik says. Spurred by the threat, she and other scientists began assessing the extent to which the L.A. wildfires primed the landscape for debris flows, even as new flames roared to life. The findings will inform decisions about when and where to warn people about the hazard. That's crucial, because avoiding debris flows is the only way to stay safe. Researchers from federal and state agencies have been surveying the areas burned by the Palisades and Eaton fires, the two largest, as well as the smaller Kenneth and Hurst fires. The field teams first study satellite imagery from before and after the areas burned for changes in vegetation cover. As flames devour leaf litter, the underlying soil loses a protective layer that shields it from erosion by rainfall. That loss is exacerbated if standing vegetation that hampers water flowing across the ground is also incinerated, and the destruction of root systems unbinds dirt and rocks, making them easier to move. Then there's how the fires alter the soil, the dirt. Gases released by burning vegetation can seep into the ground and condense into a waxy substance. The wax prevents water from percolating into the soil, resulting in more runoff on the surface, and heat can disaggregate soil particles, promoting erosion. Following a fire, it can take just a brief bout of rainfall to trigger a flash flood, and if the rushing water picks up enough sediment, it can evolve into a debris flow. These things can happen within minutes of a rainstorm, Kostelnik says. Guided by these satellite images, the teams entered the burned areas and sampled the soils of those most severely burned, says Jeremy Lancaster, a geologist who scouted the Palisades and Eaton burn scars. In each scar, teams assess how deeply and intensely the fires had burned the soil. We are typically worried about moderate to high burn severity, says Lancaster, of the California Department of Conservation. In moderately burned areas, up to 80% of litter has been burned, and surface roots may have been killed, while high-severity areas have no litter or service routes remaining. The Eaton and Palisades fires-burned areas had burned mostly at moderate severity, and hydrophobic soil layers had formed. Between the two fire areas, the Eaton Fire's burn scar appears to pose greater risk for debris flows. The Eaton Fire area has extremely steep watersheds, sloping down into Altadena, Pasadena, all the way out to Monrovia, Lancaster says. The team's observations have helped generate publicly available maps showing where debris flow hazard is greatest. Those maps will later inform decisions by officials to issue alerts and evacuation orders. Emergency planners try to anticipate debris flows using the maps and weather forecasts. They watch for storms that could drop over a centimeter of rain in 30 minutes or over a half centimeter in 15 minutes on severely burned slopes. Debris flows become much more likely at these rates, says hydrologist Jamie Labor of the National Weather Service in Oxnard, California. About 12 to 36 hours before a storm, the National Weather Service may issue a watch alert if the forecast rainfall could trigger debris flows. Once the storm has arrived, the NWS may warn that debris flows are imminent. Don't wait for the warning because it could be 0 minutes of lead time, Labor says. The watch alert is the best time to take action. Evacuations can be exhausting, especially for people displaced by the fires. Complicating the anxiety is the fact that debris flow risk can stay heightened for 2 to 5 years after a fire. Labor says, it's been really dry, so it might take a couple more years before LA really starts to recover. And a photograph shows the anatomy of a debris flow. Sloped landscapes severely burned by wildfire are at high risk for debris flows after intense bouts of rain, shown in this illustration. The flames alter soil, making it prone to erosion. First, we see a pre-wildfire hill slope, where we find intact litter layers, plants, and root systems. Then we have the wildfire-induced changes in soil and vegetation cover. The litter layer and plants are destroyed, and the soil forms a waxy layer. And then we have the rainfall-triggered debris flow in burned areas. The runoff and erosion due to hydrophobic soil causes debris flow. This article, The Next Risk, Landslides, appears in the March 2025 issue of Science News, which focuses on the aftermath of the California fires. The parts of LA affected by wildfires have different water concerns. Water in the form of rain can trigger landslides on the steep coastal slopes. But even before fires and rain, landslides have been an issue in California. From the New York Times Climate section, posted on February 19, 2025, and written by Austin Gaffney and Harry Stevens, a slow-moving California landslide suddenly speeds up. A new map shows where land movement is accelerating, buckling roads and collapsing homes. Along the sparkling coast of Southern California, a string of landslides creeping toward the sea has transformed the wealthy community of Rancho Palos Verdes into a disaster zone. New data from a NASA plane shows the widening threat of these slow-moving landslides, which have destabilized homes, businesses, and infrastructure like roads and utilities. Researchers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, documented how the landslides have pushed westward, almost doubling in area since the state mapped them in 2007. The landslides have also sped up in recent years. A month of aerial radar images taken by NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, in the fall, revealed how land in the Palos Verdes Peninsula slid toward the ocean by as much as 4 inches each week between mid-September and mid-October of last year. Before that, a city report showed more than a foot of weekly movement in July and August of last year. And a map shows the landslide boundary in 2007, and then the boundary in 2024. It is more than doubled in size. The massive slides in Los Angeles County, known as the Greater Portuguese Bend Landslide Complex, reactivated in 1956 after road construction destabilized the once dormant slope. For decades, it slid just a few inches every year. But heavy rain in 2023 and early 2024 accelerated that movement, leading Governor Gavin Newsom to declare a state of emergency, citing conditions of extreme peril to the safety of persons and property. Homes in Rancho Palos Verdes began collapsing in June and August of 2023. Streets have fissured, walls have shifted, and floors have cracked open to reveal the dynamic earth below. A downed power line related to the slides started a small brush fire in August of last year. A $42 million buyout program helps property owners voluntarily sell and relocate, but homeowner insurance policies do not typically cover landslides. Mitigating such a disaster is extremely expensive. By the end of this fiscal year, the city said it will have spent more than $35 million, almost 90% of its general fund operations budget, on addressing the landslide. That includes the installation of 11 wells that have worked to pump out 145 million gallons of groundwater that could further destabilize the slope. The investment has yielded results. The landslide slowed by about 3% on average between December and February, that is, December of 2024 and February 2025, thanks to the wells and a lack of rain, the city said. Slow-moving slides are common around the world, and especially in California, where several hundred have been mapped in coastal mountain ranges. Normally moving at a sluggish pace, these slides can grind nearly to a halt during the dry summer months before a wet winter makes them crawl again. But last summer, the landslide complex in Rancho Palos Verdes exhibited strange behavior when it failed to slow. The best guess for why has to do with a very wet 2023, said Alexander Hahnweger, a research scientist at the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who has studied the behavior of slow-moving landslides for well over a decade. Typically triggered tens of meters underground, they remain an ongoing area of research. Of all the things we know, Dr. Hahnweger said, we know the least about what's happening under the ground. Last week, other parts of Los Angeles County faced additional landslides, ones that moves quickly, running at meters per second instead of centimeters per week. The National Weather Service in Los Angeles issued warnings for post-fire debris flows, a tangle of mud, rocks, and trees that start on burn scars ahead of heavy rainfall. L.A. neighborhoods scorched by wildfires like the Eaton and Palisades fires last month faced some of the greatest dangers as those flows hit businesses and homes in Southern California. But slower-moving landslides, like the ones in Rancho Palos Verdes, are more predictable. They ooze rather than race. They typically need a season of rain rather than a single storm to accelerate, and it's extremely rare for them to suddenly collapse or slide in a catastrophic way. It's unclear what triggers that kind of sudden catastrophe, said Luke McGuire, an associate professor in geomorphology at the University of Arizona. He pointed to one of the few known examples of such an event in 2017, when the Mud Creek landslide in Big Sur gave way after 8 years of stable sliding. More than 65 feet of rocks and dirt covered a quarter mile of Highway 1, the scenic drive winding along the California coast. Experts say that the city of Rancho Palos Verdes probably will not experience that kind of sudden event. You can never say never, but the likelihood that this would go into a catastrophic movement phase is quite low, said Dave Petley, a landslide expert who collects global landslide data for the American Geophysical Union, AGU. It's likely it'll continue to cause substantial property damage, but the risk of the thing suddenly sliding into the sea and taking everyone with it is not particularly high. A 2019 Nature study by Dr. Handwerker showed that the Mud Creek landslide could have been triggered by a shift from drought to record rainfall. In a warming world, an increase in extreme rain events could cause more landslides to quicken, according to the study. More precipitation could also cause more landslides to emerge from hibernation into slow-moving slides. Rainfall under climate change can wake a landslide back up, Dr. Petley said, adding that a vast number of dormant landslides with this potential exist across the globe. And this New York Times article in the Department of Climate, "A Slow-Moving California Landslide Suddenly Speeds Up," was posted on February 19, 2025. Next, a look at artificial intelligence, part of Science News' 2024 Year in Review, in the article entitled "Power Hungry" by Lauren Leffer. Is the promise of generative AI enough to justify its vast and growing energy consumption? It might seem like magic. Type a request into ChatGPT, click a button, and presto, here's a 5-paragraph analysis of Shakespeare's Hamlet. And as an added bonus, it's written in iambic pentameter. Or tell DALL-E about the chimeric animal from your dream, and out comes an image of a gecko-wolf-starfish hybrid. If you're feeling down, call up the digital ghost of your deceased grandmother and receive some comfort. Despite how it may appear, none of this materializes out of thin air. Every interaction with a chatbot or other generative AI system funnels through wires and cables to a data center, a warehouse full of server stacks that pass these prompts through the billions and potentially trillions of parameters that dictate how a generative model responds. Processing and answering prompts eats up electricity, as does the supporting infrastructure like fans and air conditioning that cool the whirring servers. In addition to big utility bills, the result is a lot of climate-warming carbon emissions. Electricity generation and server cooling also suck up tons of water, which is used in fossil fuel and nuclear energy production, and for evaporative or liquid heat dissipation systems. This year, as the popularity of generative AI continued to surge, environmentalists sounded the alarm about this resource-hungry technology. The debate over how to weigh the costs against the less tangible benefits that generative AI brings, such as increased productivity and information access, is steeped in ideological divisions over the purpose and value of technology. Advocates argue this latest revolution in AI is a societal good, even a necessity, that's bringing us closer than ever to artificial general intelligence, hyper-capable computer systems that some argue could be a paradigm-shifting technology, on par with the printing press or the internet. Generative AI is an accelerator for anything you want to do, says Rick Stevens, an associate lab director at Argonne National Laboratory and a computer scientist at the University of Chicago. In his view, the tech has already enabled major productivity gains for businesses and researchers. One analysis found 40% gains in performance when skilled workers used AI tools, he notes. AI assistants can boost vocabulary learning in schools, he adds, or help physicians diagnose and treat patients, and improve access to medical information, says Charlotte Blees, an interdisciplinary researcher at Uppsala University in Sweden, who studies health data. Generative AI might even help city planners cut down on traffic and reduce carbon emissions in the process, or help government agencies better forecast the weather, says Priya Donti, an electrical engineer and computer scientist at MIT and co-founder of the nonprofit Climate Change AI. The list goes on. Now, at this critical juncture, experts from fields as varied as economics, computer engineering, and sustainability are working to assess the true burden of the technology. How much energy does AI consume? ChatGPT and other generative tools are power-hungry, says Alex DeVries, founder of the research and consulting agency DigiEconomist and a PhD candidate at Vrije Universiteit Amsterdam. The larger you make these models, the more parameters, the more data, the better they perform. But of course, bigger also requires more computational resources to train and run them, requiring more power, says DeVries, who studies the environmental impact of technologies like cryptocurrency and AI. Bigger is better works for generative AI, but it doesn't work for the environment. Training generative AI models to spit out an analysis of Shakespeare or the image of a fantastical animal is costly. The process involves developing an AI architecture, amassing and storing reams of digital data, and then having the AI system ingest and incorporate that data, which can amount to everything publicly available on the internet, into its decision-making processes. Honing models to be more human-like and avoid unsafe responses takes additional effort. All told, training a single model uses more energy than 100 U.S. homes in a year. Querying ChatGPT uses about 10 times as much energy as a standard online search, according to the International Energy Agency. Composing an email with an AI chatbot can take 7 times as much energy as fully charging an iPhone 16, some researchers estimate. Though training is clearly a big resource suck, when millions of people rely on chatbots for everyday tasks, it adds up, says Xiaolei Ren, an electrical and computer engineer at the University of California, Riverside. So much so that the AI sector could soon draw as much energy annually as the Netherlands, DeVries estimated in 2023 in the journal Joule. Given generative AI's rapid growth, the current trajectory already exceeds the prediction. And that's just electricity. 10 to 50 ChatGPT queries use half a liter of water, per a 2023 analysis by Wren and colleagues. That turned out to be a big underestimate too, he says, off by a factor of 4. Some engineers and AI experts dispute these numbers. I don't understand what the science is behind these estimates, says David Patterson, an engineer at Google and professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. The only way I can imagine getting an accurate answer could be with close cooperation with a company like Google. Right now, that's impossible. Tech companies release limited information about their data centers and AI models, says DeVries and Wren. So it's hard to precisely assess the cradle-to-grave cost of AI or predict the future. In their estimates, both researchers relied on proxies, such as AI server production numbers from the tech company NVIDIA, or combining knowledge on data center locations with info from corporate sustainability reports. Real-world trends, however, do point to AI's voracious energy appetite. For decades before the generative AI boom, efficiency gains have compensated for the growing energy demand that comes with expansions in data centers and computing, says Andrew Chin, a computer scientist at the University of Chicago. That's changed. By the end of 2020, data center expansion began to outpace efficiency improvements, he says. Both Google's and Microsoft's self-reported energy usage more than doubled between 2019 and 2023. ChatGPT's release at the end of 2022 kickstarted a generative AI frenzy exacerbating the issue, Chen says. Before 2022, total energy demand in the U.S. had been stable for about 15 years. Now it's rising. The easiest way to save energy is not to do anything, Patterson says, but progress involves investment and costs. Generative AI is a very young technology, and stopping now would stymie its potential, he argues. It's too early to know that generative AI won't more than compensate the investment. A more sustainable path for AI. The decision need not be between shutting down generative AI development entirely or allowing it to continue unrestrained. Instead, most experts note there's a more responsible way to approach the technology, mitigating the risks and maximizing the rewards. Policies requiring companies to disclose where and how they're using generative AI, as well as the corresponding energy consumption, would be a step in the right direction, says Lynn Keck, a computer scientist and public policy expert at the Hertie School in Berlin. Regulating uses of the technology and access to it may prove difficult, but Keck says that's key to minimizing environmental and social harm. Perhaps not everyone, for instance, should be able to freely produce voice clones and photorealistic images with a single click. Should we pour the same amount of resources into supporting a generative meme machine as we do for running a hurricane forecasting model? More research into the tech's limitations could also save lots of futile consumption. AI is very powerful in certain kinds of applications, but completely useless in others, Keck says. Meanwhile, data centers and AI developers could take steps to lessen their carbon emissions and resource use, Chen says. Simple changes like training models only when there's ample carbon-free power on the grid, say on sunny days when solar panels produce an excess of energy, or subtly reducing system performance at times of peak energy demand, might make a measurable difference. Replacing water-intensive evaporative cooling with liquid immersion cooling or other closed-loop strategies that allow for water recycling would also minimize demand. Each of these choices involves trade-offs. Maybe more carbon-efficient systems generally use more water, Ren says. There is no one-size-fits-all solution. The alternative to exploring and incentivizing these options, even if they make it marginally harder for companies to develop ever bigger AI models, is risking part of our collective environmental fate, he says. There's no reason to believe that technology is going to save us, Chen says. So why not hedge our bets? This article, Power Hungry, A Review of AI, is part of Science News' 2024 Year in Review. Now we turn to advances in the December 2024 issue of Scientific American. From the Department of Animal Behavior in Advances, Cultural Construction. Culture may play a role in birds' nest architecture. From long and winding migration flights to intricate songs and clever tool use, many bird behaviors are known to be transmitted socially and persist across generations, what scientists define as animal culture. Now, a study suggests that culture may play a role in avian architecture, too. Researchers analyzed more than 400 structures built by 43 different groups of white-browed sparrow weavers in the Kalahari Desert in southern Africa. These birds live communally, and the entire cohort works together to build a nest and multiple roosts from grass. The group's dominant female then lays eggs in the nest, which has a long tube-like entrance. Individual birds slumber nearby in the U-shaped roosts, which have both an entrance and an exit. The scientists found that different gatherings of birds, even those living only a few meters from one another, built very different tube structures. The biggest difference was in how short or long the structures are, says study lead author Maria C. Tello Ramos, a cognitive ecologist at the University of Hull in England. Tube width also varied between groups. Furthermore, each group maintained the same architectural style over time, and when outsiders joined, they adapted to this style. To examine why the groups built differently, the team analyzed factors that can determine a nest size and shape for a given bird species: weather conditions, tree height, individual's body size, and genetic relatedness. If closely related birds build similar structures, for instance, one might assume a genetic element. Yet none of these factors seem to play a relevant role in shaping how the Kalahari sparrows built their nests, the researchers reported in the journal Science. Then we say, okay, so what is left? Tello Ramos explains. She and her colleagues proposed that cultural transmission might be key to nest building. In our paper, we haven't gotten there yet with experiments, but we have very good clues that that might be it, she says. These are important questions that are understudied, says Christina Riehl, an evolutionary biologist at Princeton University. She's not convinced the study's data are enough to fully rule out genetic influence. They can't really look at the effect of, say, genetic differences, because they don't really have good genetic information on all the individuals in these groups, she says. I think there's a lot left to be done, and I think this paper will inspire future research in a really good way. This article posted by Gennaro Toma. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.